This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Symbolically, for that to fall to the RSF, that would be a huge blow, in particular to the victims of the RSF and their historical Janjaweed, because that was a place where people sought safety and security.
That was Human Rights Watch Deputy Director Nicole Withersheim on reports the paramilitary group RSF has taken control of Sudan's second largest city. Details coming up. Also, the United Nations says at least 70 UN workers have died in the conflict between Israel and Hamas. And the African Growth and Opportunity Act Summit kicks off in Johannesburg today. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The paramilitary rapid support forces, which have been battling the army for control of Sudan, said today they have seized Nayala, the country's second largest city. Seizure of the capital of South Darfur state could mark a significant turn in Sudan's six-month-old war and comes as the two sides are supposed to restart talks in Jeddah. Human Rights Watch Deputy Director Nicole Withersheim, who lived in Nayala for nearly 2 years, beginning in 2005, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that the city is an economic hub. It's also been a place of refuge for hundreds of thousands of displaced people over the last 20 years, especially in 2004 when the U.S. government recognized the mass killings in Darfur as genocide.
The UN had a large base there, as did the Sudanese Armed Forces. So symbolically, for that to fall to the RSF, that would be a huge blow, in particular to the victims of the RSF and their historical Janjaweed, because that was a place where people sought safety and security. And Kalma refugee camp, which is a massive displacement camp during the height of the Darfur crisis of 2005 to 2007, is still there. And it became, not appropriately, but it became the home to people, to victims of the crisis from 20 years ago, who never got their land back. And now they will, the possibility that they would be under the authority of the RSF and former Janjaweed is just absolutely heartbreaking.
In Darfur, we've been hearing for, you know, several weeks now, in fact, months, that, you know, the fighting has spread out in parts of Darfur from the capital. Are most people gone by now, or are there still quite a few civilians living there?
I don't know of mass displacement from Nayala in fear of this. I believe that the people have stayed, but I can't confirm that. In West Darfur, where Human Rights Watch has been working and documenting the severe violence and atrocities that occurred in June, we know that a lot of those communities are gone. They were chased out, killed. Many tried to get to Chad. The Chad camps have swelled. Our teams have been in Chad talking to the victims of the West Darfur violence, but there's not a lot of people from the Mosalit and other communities left there. You know, I think we can't see this in a vacuum. I think the RSF is gaining ground, and because of the talks going on in Jeddah and the big push by sponsors of those talks to try to get to a cessation of hostilities, which, of course, everybody wants to see the violence stop. But every time, in most places, when you see mediation and negotiations finally getting traction, you see a big surge of violence. And, you know, who's going to pay for that are the civilians, who are most of whom are already displaced and have been victims of cyclical violence for 20 years.
There's a statement that was put out today with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's name on it, warning the RSF against what Washington calls signs of an imminent large-scale attack in North Darfur's capital. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm really glad to see Secretary Blinken making space and time to comment on this massive crisis in light of other world events. There are estimates, not from Human Rights Watch, but there are estimates that over 9,000 people have been killed in this conflict, which has only been going on since April. So I'm glad Secretary of State is weighing in on this. We have been with other organizations pressing the U.S. State Department to determine what level of atrocities have occurred in this war. And so I feel like his statement is giving yet another warning to the RSF. We're watching you. And I hope that means that the State Department will both release its assessment of what has occurred to date and also who is accountable.
That's Nicole Widdersheim, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch, speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam. The African Growth and Opportunity Act Summit kicks off in Johannesburg today with African members seeking to boost the benefits they get from the United States government program. In 2022, according to the U.S. government, eligible sub-Saharan countries exported goods worth almost $10 billion to American markets. Products included fruit and vegetables, oil and precious metals. Darren Taylor reports.
For the next 2 days, African governments and private companies will engage counterparts from the U.S. about improving the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. The treaty gives products from some African countries tax-free access to American markets. Major beneficiaries of AGOA include South Africa, Nigeria, and Ghana. To qualify for AGOA, countries must meet certain requirements, such as holding democratic values and respecting human rights. An AGOA expert at South Africa's Standard Bank, Kenny Fichler, says the pacts become indispensable to the economic growth of many countries since President Bill Clinton launched it 23 years ago.
The automobile sector in South Africa is a massive exporter into the U.S. If you look at the smaller countries who are producing apparels and textiles, they're also benefiting hugely, having been able to export around $1.5 billion into the U.S. And there's still massive scope for growth. And if one then looks at the potential of expanding further exports, widening the scope to cover more countries who are included in AGOA, as well as increasing the volumes, there's no doubt that this is hugely beneficial to African economies and would also help us to modernize our own production and improve the quality of our goods.
Kenya, Lesotho, and Madagascar have benefited from exporting clothing and textiles to the U.S. under AGOA. At this week's forum, says Fichler, African countries will push Washington to extend AGOA for 10 more years to reassure businesses and investors who have concerns about the program's future.
From an African point of view, there's a lot that we need to do ourselves. Firstly, the standardization of our own policies and macroeconomic environment so that as the U.S. interacts with Africa, it does not have to negotiate with multiple countries with different rules and different requirements. And this then links to the value that the African Continental Free Trade Area can actually bring to the fore. That harmonization of rules, which must also lead to the development of the infrastructure for Africa to be able to move these goods to the requisite market.
South African economist Kevin Lings told VOA a major point of discussion at the summit will be the underutilization of AGOA. He says only about half the countries that qualify have developed strategies designed to make best use of AGOA, with most exports to the US being from only a few beneficiaries.
The sub-Saharan African continent exports way more to China in a year than it does to the United States, even though we've got preferential access to the United States. There isn't enough knowledge in Africa about how do I get access to this preferential trade agreement? How do I get my goods included? Who do I speak to? That sort of practical knowledge. I think there's a lot more that can be done to just simply boost people's awareness. South Africa and many other African countries have been guilty of not developing their manufacturing capacity. And so they've increasingly relied on commodities and commodity exports. China's a big consumer of commodities. So quite frankly, it was easy to export commodities to China, not drive exports of value-added or manufactured goods to the United States.
Yesterday, U.S. President Joe Biden issued a statement urging the U.S. Congress to reauthorize AGOA by 2025. Saying it has been a bedrock for U.S. trade with sub-Saharan Africa. The US recently dropped four countries from AGOA, Gabon and Niger, after coups ousted elected governments, and the Central African Republic and Uganda for human rights violations. Uganda's government condemned the move, saying it was intended to punish countries for resisting the imposition of Western values. Mauritania was reinstated to the program because of its efforts to improve workers' rights. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The main United Nations office handling aid in Gaza today said at least 70 UN workers have died in the conflict between Israel and Hamas. Also today, more than 300 foreign nationals have crossed into Egypt at the Rafah border point following weeks of talks among Egypt, Israel, the US, and Qatar, which mediates with Hamas. Egypt's government has said it will help about 7,000 foreign nationals and their families leave Gaza. Israel and Hezbollah militants in Lebanon exchanged missiles today and last night. Israel's ground troops today continue to advance towards Gaza City as diplomatic efforts intensified for at least a brief pause in the fighting in Gaza's deadliest war. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he supports a humanitarian pause in fighting to allow aid into Gaza. Secretary of State Antony Blinken returns to the region tomorrow and is expected to discuss that goal. The Palestinian death toll in the last Israel-Hamas war has topped 9,000, and the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says thousands more have been injured. In the occupied West Bank, more than 130 Palestinians have been killed in violence and Israeli raids. More than 1,400 people in Israel have been killed, most of them in the October 7th Hamas attack that started the fighting, and around 240 hostages were taken from Israel into Gaza by the militant group. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Linda Gratstein in Jerusalem for an update on the situation there.
Overnight and into today, there are very heavy fighting between Israeli soldiers who are now at the outskirts of Gaza City, fairly deep into the northern Gaza Strip, with Hamas gunmen. Israel says that dozens of Hamas gunmen have been killed, and Israeli army engineers are now working to blow up this entire network of tunnels that Hamas has built underneath Gaza. Israel says that the tunnels include a large Hamas command post, which is actually below the Shifa hospital. And so there is concern that as Israel tries to blow up these tunnels, that it will also kill innocent civilians. Now, Israel did tell the civilians to leave for a couple of weeks already from northern Gaza to southern Gaza, but many of them just don't have any place to go. In addition, the Palestinian Health Ministry says that more than 9,000 Palestinians have been killed since the beginning of the fighting. But I think it's important to say, first of all, that the Palestinian Health Ministry is affiliated with Hamas. It doesn't distinguish between Hamas gunmen and civilians. And in addition, several hundred rockets that Hamas has fired have fallen short. That was the whole story about that hospital that we had a couple of weeks ago when Hamas immediately blamed Israel. And it turned out that according to the best intelligence estimates, it really was an Islamic Jihad rocket that had misfired. But we're talking about heavy fighting in Gaza that has killed dozens of fighters, presumably hundreds of civilians today, and 18 Israeli soldiers.
And Linda, meanwhile, the UN has said the Israeli attack on Gaza's biggest refugee camp, the UN is saying that could amount to war crimes after maybe about 195 Palestinians were killed over the course of a two-day bombardment.
Yes, that was the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, where Israel says that there were some senior Hamas officials there, and has said that basically that Hamas has been using women and children as a human shield. And Israel has said that, you know, and in fact, according to one report, Hamas actually sent a group of women and children into the camp to protect it. And Israel has said that it's a, you know, unfortunate kind of casualty of war, that it wasn't targeting the camp, that it was targeting these Hamas gunmen.
And Linda, what is this humanitarian pause? Because President Biden has called for a humanitarian pause in Gaza, but stops short on calling for a ceasefire.
You know, first of all, it's not exactly clear, but presumably it would be a limited amount of time that the fighting would stop, that would allow both at least some of the Israeli hostages that Hamas is holding, there are about 240 of them, including dozens of women and children, that they would be released, perhaps in exchange for Israel allowing fuel into Gaza. Israel has allowed more food and medicine and water, although human rights organizations say the need is still very great and there needs to be more humanitarian aid. But Israel has not allowed fuel, saying that the fuel could be used by Hamas for rockets or to power the tunnels. The hospitals in Gaza say that if they don't get fuel soon, the humanitarian crisis will be even worse. So there is some sort of an American and Qatar broker deal, perhaps, to temporarily stop the fighting. Now, Israel has said it won't agree to a ceasefire, that agreeing to a ceasefire, in effect, with leaving Hamas with the capability to still fight and to still fire rockets, it would, in effect, be a victory for Hamas. So it is said it won't agree to a ceasefire, but there hasn't been anything about whether or not Israel would agree to this humanitarian pause that President Biden mentioned, or exactly what he meant. In addition, Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrives in the region tomorrow, and obviously this is going to be one of the things on his agenda, as well as the humanitarian situation in Gaza.
That was Linda Grantstein. She talked to me earlier from Jerusalem. As Israel intensifies its military offensive in Gaza, the humanitarian crisis in the enclave is worsening, and violence against Palestinians in the West Bank is on the rise. At the same time, Israelis are feeling unsafe as tens of thousands are displaced. Nearly 9,000 Gaza residents have died in the conflict, and more than 1,400 Israelis have been killed. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi has more.
Officials with the United Nations Agency coordinating humanitarian aid operations in Gaza report that people are forced to live on the very basics, such as bread and water. Israeli forces have bombarded and attacked the Gaza Strip since Hamas militants attacked Israeli communities on October 7th. Israel also has blockaded the territory, and only a few hundred trucks carrying food, water, and medicines have been allowed in. The World Health Organization warns a public health catastrophe is imminent in Gaza because of mass displacement, overcrowding, and damaged water systems. Dalia Hattouqa is a Palestinian journalist living in Ramallah on the West Bank. During an online panel discussion this week at the Arab Center in Washington, she described the situation in Gaza. She says, "The Israeli government has threatened medical facilities which shelter tens of thousands of injured and displaced Palestinians.
The infrastructure in Gaza has been devastated. Having already cut off food, water, fuel to Gaza's population, there's also a very heavy restriction on the entry of humanitarian aid. Unfortunately, we can expect the humanitarian catastrophe to worsen in the coming weeks because of the Israeli ground invasion."
The United Nations also says Israeli settler violence has increased against Palestinians in the West Bank, and nearly 1,000 people there have been displaced. Hattouqa says settlers use the fact that all eyes are on Gaza to attack Palestinians in the West Bank.
Both Israeli soldiers and settlers have killed at least 120 Palestinians. This makes it the West Bank's deadliest period in at least 15 years, according to the UN. 33 of those were children. The armed settlers have been increasing their attacks on Palestinian communities across the West Bank, and often they're escorted by soldiers. They are contributing to the displacement of Palestinians in the West Bank.
U.S. President Joe Biden has said that attacks by extremist settlers against Palestinians were worsening the conflict. Israeli officials say it has been conducting raids in the West Bank to hunt Hamas militants and other fighters. It has detained hundreds of people it says are suspected militants. Mayrav Zonzain is an Israeli analyst at the International Crisis Group living in Tel Aviv. During the Arab Center event, she said, people in Israel are dealing with the trauma of the Hamas attack. She said, there is anger directed directly at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the October 7th attack.
You also have over 120,000 Israelis who are internally displaced because they can't live in the south anymore. Their houses were damaged. It's now kind of a security zone. Also in the north, in the border with Lebanon, several communities have been evacuated because of the skirmishes there. So you have really a lot of chaos and a lot of trauma in Israel right now. And you have kind of like an overwhelming sentiment that the safety, the insecurity has been completely lost.
Zonzain noted that while Israelis in general support the military offensive to eradicate Hamas, many people want to see Netanyahu leave office. She said the October 7th attack showed Israeli politicians that the country are not invincible and that the prolonged Palestinian-Israeli conflict cannot be contained or pushed aside. The United Nations, the United States, European Union, and other governments have called for a ceasefire or at least a humanitarian pause in the fighting to allow aid into Gaza. Prime Minister Netanyahu, however, has rejected calls for a ceasefire. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA, Washington.
The World Meteorological Organization warns that climate change is generating a global health crisis, but says many of the ill effects can be tempered by adaptation and prevention measures. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Meteorological Organization reports the world is warming at a faster rate than at any point in recorded history. It warns climate change threatens to reverse decades of progress toward better health and well-being, particularly in the most vulnerable communities. WMO Secretary General Petteri Talas says the countries most at risk from climate change are in Africa and South Asia, where it fuels vector-borne diseases such as dengue and malaria. He says food insecurity is growing, and increasingly more frequent heat waves are worsening the impact of extreme weather events.
For example, in the Horn of Africa, during the past 3 years, we had very severe food insecurity situation, which was related to both heat and drought. And quite often in these episodes when we have heat waves, we have also fairly poor air quality.
WMO reports extreme heat causes more deaths than any other extreme weather event. Between 2000 and 2019, it estimates excessive heat killed nearly 500,000 people a year, with Asia and Europe particularly affected. It says heat waves also worsen air pollution, which is responsible for an estimated 7 million premature deaths every year and is posing increased risks as climate change kicks in. Talas says climate information and services can help manage the damage from extreme weather events, predict health risks, and save lives. He says early warning systems for extreme heat and pollen monitoring to help allergy sufferers are very important. Unfortunately, he adds, well-functioning early warning services in African countries and many other states are very limited.
One of the sectors where many African countries don't have services are these health services, and many African countries are not able to provide heat warnings for their population, and their authorities have limitations in coping with such warnings.
Talas says WMO has set up a major early warning services program to help countries in Africa and elsewhere improve their management of environmental health and climate services. He says countries can prevent human casualties and minimize economic losses from extreme weather events by improving their early warning systems. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Baro, and our engineer, Kelly Williams, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.